Welcome to the Commentary Daily Podcast. Today is Monday, April 13th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Senior Writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Associate Editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us again, our repeat guest, Andrew Ferguson of The Atlantic. Hi, Andy.
Hello, John.
So, everybody, we have now entered into, for some of us, the fifth week of our, neo-quarantine lockdown, however you want to slice it. We here in New York are seeing this phenomenon again, which is that the current death toll is horrific and deep, but the curve has flattened unambiguously, and the number of emergency room admissions for COVID-19 are going down from their high, and will continue to, every indication is they will continue, we're at a plateau, and they will continue to start going down in a bit. So that leads to the question that is raised here every 5 minutes by certain people, which is, when is this over? And we exist in a reality where, and maybe we can talk about what this means civilizationally, where the real question that is raised for some of us is there a risk level that the country is willing to accept to reopen? By which I mean, the country reopens and people understand that after the country reopens, people are still going to get infected. Workplaces are still going to have people in them who get infected, and that people are either going to be willing to take their chances and go to restaurants and go to bars and go to workplaces and go to movies or what, or we no longer live in a world where that is even thinkable exactly. The problem with that is that there is no way to get the risk level to zero until there is a vaccine. So we are therefore looking at a mindset that doesn't leave the national consciousness for a year, apparently, unless the fact that every great mind in the world is going to be working on this problem and this problem alone could lead to some methodological breakthroughs that make it so that the vaccine doesn't take a year. Maybe it takes 6 months or something. I don't know. Andy, as a moral historian, because that's how I like to think about you. As a moral do we Americans in 2020, or indeed a world, people of the world in the 21st century, do we have the emotional capacity to assume that level, any level of existential risk of this sort?
Boy, did you say existential?
Wasn't that good? I thought that I could go with,
As someone once said, that's when I reach for my revolver and swing and abuse the word existential.
Yes.
On me. I think it's a really tricky question, obviously, because you have to reach a consensus of some kind, because everybody's going to have differing views on it. And I think the only sort of public or governmental response to it is, this is my libertarian side coming out, is going to be maximum freedom for business owners or, people who run churches and sporting events and things like that. People are going to have to decide that for themselves. And then, you know, whether they want their employees to come back into a workspace or they want to have their team out playing on a field and they'll let spectators in. And then the market will reply and will say, no, people are not comfortable enough yet to go see a baseball game, or they don't want to sit next to their coworker, or, you know, whatever those various conclusions are. And my worry is that, I mean, this whole idea of, you know, Trump saying, and the press going along with him, you know, I'm going to reopen things. Well, he didn't close anything. I mean, he does think he's God, and so does the press, I guess. So he's just going to, like, well, this is a big decision I have to make. He can say whatever the hell he wants, and nobody's going to do it simply because he says so.
Yeah. So this, I mean, a little existential, at least. This story about this, we're talking about this before the camera started, the mic started rolling, is this pork processing plant that has closed is a really interesting tale. So this is a pork processing facility, major one in South Dakota. 240 employees got the disease. They couldn't maintain operations anymore. They had to shut down. This is an essential facility. It cuts between 4% and 5% of the nation's pork supply. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. It's like 18 million servings of pork per day offline, off the supply chain. Now, so how do you navigate that environment moving forward? It's clear that being open is an incredible risk to the people who are working. It's clear being closed is an incredible risk to everyone who's not. How do you navigate this divide? It's a wild catch 22.
I mean, I could at least envision small towns, rural communities sort of getting to the point where they could live with numbers that are genuinely low and go on about their lives. Very hard to see the sense of risk taking that would be involved for big cities.
Well, or even think in terms of schools, right? So you might have a sort of a large number of parents who say, yeah, you know what, we know the risks, we understand them, but we want to get our kids back to school in the fall. It really only takes one litigious parent suing a school district because their kid got sick for that really to become a problem for the school district and the people who have to make these decisions. I mean, we are a fairly litigious people. And I wonder, I mean, if I'm in the position of looking at the legal risk to my small business or to my institution, that's going to have to be weighed in. Either that, or you're going to have people sign, you know, the same waiver you sign basically when you get a hot pizza. Like, if I get burned, I won't sue you. I mean, but there'll be layers and layers of that sort of protective paperwork that are going to have to be in place for a lot of business owners, just for peace of mind, or for to satisfy the requirements of their insurers at this point, right? Because this is a whole new set of risks that we aren't able to yet know the end of until there's a vaccine. So I mean, look, if I was an insurance company insuring small businesses, I would probably say you can reopen, but your people who come through your door have to waive all, you know, acknowledge the risk.
Okay, so I think it's fair to say that if we need a consensus, the consensus at the moment is for the country shutdown. Despite if you're a reader on Twitter and you see you watch Sean Hannity or something like that, because, you know, there are these poll numbers, like Gavin Newsom has an 83% poll approval rating, and, you know, 80% of the country thinks we've done the right thing so far and all of that. So people seem to be basically in national agreement about what's happened so far. And some of us are getting a distorted picture of this, reading social media and being sort of in the among the elite of the, okay, when are we going to reopen? So it may well be that this is a misreading or a misunderstanding of how this works, that people are getting frantic, or it's a species of, you know, living where the shutdown really started a month ago, which isn't most of the country, actually. And so for the parts of the country where the shutdown hasn't really happened yet, sure. Or schools are out. There's massive inconvenience. I don't mean that, but it's not sheltering in place and that sort of thing. But even the places where people are sheltering in place, my sense is that people want more draconian rather than less draconian measures or accepting of them because they're afraid of the virus. So I don't know that there will ever be consensus, in part because of the troublemaking aspect of social media, by which I mean, let me just give you an example of this, and maybe we can shift to this. Why are the liberal media so intent on getting Trump to fire Anthony Fauci? Because I don't see any other way to read this effort to stir up as much dissension between Fauci and Trump. This is a species of journalists asking questions at the press conference, pushing this, pushing that, and knowing that Trump, if they can make the case to Trump somehow, that Fauci is disloyal or or bad, or is, you know, that that'll push his buttons and he'll. Do they want him to fire Fauci? I mean, I by the way am kind of agnostic on Fauci in this sense, which is I love listening to him. I like his voice and all of that. From what I can tell, he's mostly being a PR person now. He seems to be talking to the press 3 to 5 hours a day. And that means that he's not running his agency exactly. He's being a sort of public spokesman about viruses and epidemiology and all of that, and much less, being a hands-on manager of the crisis. So I don't know, maybe it wouldn't matter if he were fired or weren't fired, but it just seems like a bizarre, masochistic, aggressive, anti-Trump psychosis to be pushing this as the implicitly or esoterically pushing this as a narrative.
But it's not, I don't think it's masochistic. I think they wanted to fire Fauci so then they could say, look what a jerk Trump is.
But why do they want to
need more evidence?
Right.
Well, it's the same impulse that we saw. Look, over the weekend, the Times did this big story, interesting story about, the early warnings that were ignored. You know, these stories come out every time. There were tons of them after 9/11. Anytime there's any sort of national crisis. And I'm with the caveat that this actually is the job of reporters to go back and look and sift through and find, what went wrong. And hopefully we learn from that. But there is a kind of zeal with which and speed with which this is being done in real time with this virus, right? So we're going back to January and the warnings internally that Trump ignored or downplayed, which are newsworthy in the sense that Trump is now arguing that he didn't ignore them and didn't downplay these things. Like, so he's giving press conferences where he says, oh, I was aware, I was on top of things from day one. Well, he wasn't. But the tone of all of these stories strikes me as being almost lascivious in its effort to prove that it's Trump's fault, right? I mean, there is a kind of tone there that's separate from the facts that are being accrued. And that, I think, it's that tone to which, unfortunately, Trump responds in a series of insane Easter tweets, which are totally unhelpful, and as are, his extemporaneous remarks during his press conferences. But there is... it's difficult for me when I read those stories to separate the tone from the facts I'm reading about, because the facts are useful and it's good to know what we should have seen ahead of time and what not. But the speculation tends to err on the side of, again, blame Trump, blame Trump, blame Trump. Not that he doesn't deserve some blame, but I mean, maybe I'm overreading these stories. Did you guys read this one in the Times over the weekend? It's getting a lot of attention.
Yeah. So speaking of that story, so from what I gather, there was an email, there was a sort of chat email group.
Red Dawn.
Yeah, Red Dawn that like said, this could be really bad. And so therefore that proves that we should have shut the country down in January. I mentioned this the other week, Roberta Wahlstetter's book on Pearl Harbor, which lays out the fact that, yes, everybody knew that maybe the Japanese were an aggressive military power in the late 1930s that were taking over China, and that there were these bits of data that indicated that they might attack us, but that absent the attack on us, the idea that the bureaucracy could actually achieve a level of readiness to retard the attack or fight back or something like that is hindsight is like insane hindsight. Like, this is the problem with hindsight is you assume the emotional understanding that happens after something happens and then project it backward. So it's like when Bush gets a report on August 6, 2001 saying Al-Qaeda determined to attack inside the U.S., we should have gone on high. We should have gone to DEFCON. What is the highest DEFCON? 5 or 1? I can't even remember. 1.
One.
We should have gone to DEFCON 1. But it didn't say when, it didn't say where, it didn't say what method, it didn't say anything except all the chatter suggests they're determined to attack the U.S. And yet, if it's politically convenient for you, you can then use that to say Bush was a failure. And I mean, I think this is exactly the same.
So do I. And also, you know, these things, to have cut off such threats early enough when it would have made a difference, would require policies for which there would have been zero political will at the time.
Right.
I mean, or evidence, or evidentiary data to support that conclusion. There's also a lot of effort to absolve the WHO of its role in this thing, and which is, I can't understand that at all, except for the fact that Trump is the better target here, if you're a political right. reporter.
Anthony Fauci himself said, I believe on January 29th, that there was no evidence of human-to-human transition in China. That was at the end of January.
What the Chinese were telling him.
Right.
And who was doing that, saying the same thing.
And aside from, you know, some due and appropriate suspicion of Chinese data, there's no evidence to suggest that we should have questioned that evidence, because they hadn't been this opaque in past respiratory outbreak.
Well, the only reason to doubt the evidence was that they quarantined 750 million people for a disease that didn't go from human to human. I mean, that's something where you can't entirely.
But we didn't know that they weren't classifying people who didn't test symptomatic, were untested, or false negatives that weren't being included, and that sort of thing. We didn't know that
as late as early
and mid February.
Well, we don't know.
In February, there were public officials and health experts and industry people in the medical community who were saying, "Look, the thing to worry about here is seasonal flu," including the sainted Andrew Cuomo, who said as much in the second week of February.
Well, there's a lot of memory holing, right? That's the interesting thing. So Trump was trying to memory hole his inattentiveness or something by saying, no, I put the travel ban on China and I did this and I did that and all of that. And then you have like the public officials in New York, like this guy Mark Levine, who is the chairman of the health committee of the New York City Council, which is to say he's the jerk of the jerk body who's a jerk, who on February 9th was telling everybody to go to the Chinese New Year parade. And then in March is like, you know, everybody dig a hole and get in the hole and, you know, get oxygen for 6 years. You know, it's like, no, I'm sorry. You know, tweets live forever. You said everybody should go to the Chinese New Year parade, which is obviously was probably one of the sources of the New York City outbreak, like the Mardi Gras thing in New Orleans was the source there. So there's a lot of, and Cuomo's memory holing, you know.
Also, there's this notion that the only people who didn't want this are political officials, hidebound, who are just beholden to political sentiment, while all the experts in the world were warning about how this is going to be exactly what it is today. Yeah. And it's just simply not true. And I wrote about this for the magazine, is there was an industry survey conducted, or released rather, on February 13th that showed among medical professionals that 9% of those surveyed were very concerned, quote, very concerned about this situation. Right. And all of them, most of them at least, said and gave quotes in this story saying, look, if seasonal influenza is the bigger threat here. You shouldn't really have to worry about this sort of thing, because nobody really was all that worried about it. Yeah. Except for a couple of civilizationist conservatives and, you know, people who study collapse of civilization as a hobby. I mean, those are the people who were really invested in it.
They're like, the black swan is here, yes.
So, I mean, I know that there were a couple. So this is the whole question of, like, who really had the interest in finding out about this except as an intellectual exercise before bodies start coming? Who actually made a serious study of this early? And that is like somebody I know at a successful hedge fund with, you know, tens of billions of dollars under management, starting in early to mid-January, said, this is like, let's put our research department on this and watch this on an hourly basis. And by like February 1st was like, everybody make a contingency plan. Everybody who work here, find another place, because New York City is gonna get shut down. You know, New York City and the ancillary place, like, are gonna get shut down any second now. So we have to find other ways to work. We have to do this. We have to do that. We need to, you know, we need to hedge our risk because.
Why didn't he tell the rest of us?
Because, because like you also
you don't have $1 billion, Andy.
That's true. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, but I mean, part of this was this, you know, that was his abundance of caution. But I'm just saying, like, he or this firm, they had a, you know, this was a this was an extinction level event for them if they or conversely something that they could weather better than other places if they got on it right. And the abundance of caution is if it doesn't work out, they had enough assets so that it wasn't all that costly to make all these contingency plans. But where you have there is a direct financial interest in making sure that this was the case. Whereas in the government, you know, you have all these conflicting pressures, right, that governments go through. Like, you don't want to inconvenience people. You have labor contracts. I mean, that's part of the funny thing about all this talk about schools and distance learning and remote learning, all this, is that nobody has taken account of the fact how much decision-making is going on because of union power in municipal and state governments in blue states. You know, do you shut the school system down? No, because, you know, you have union contracts to fulfill. What? How do you handle all of this? It's not all just, you know, we need to make sure that the children are fine. You know, there are lots of different kinds of pressures at play.
Well, that goes to Abe's point, which seems to me, I can't tell you how much I hate all this hindsight journalism. I mean, there would be a great time to do that when people can speak more freely and all of that sort of thing. That Time story was just, from what I could tell, it was just one disgruntled or buck passing employee or civil servant after another kind of trying to titillate New York Times reporters. But the idea that there was ever any kind of political interest for anyone to have when you've got, you know, 12 people dead and you say, okay, we're going to shut the country down. It's absurd on its face. It never would have happened. Fauci was trying to say this yesterday. He had this browbeating interview with Jake Tapper.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, well, there was a lot of pushback from this. And Fauci himself seems to be very self-aware that he is the disease guy. He's the germ virus guy. And the president is has a different role, you know, and the civil servants have a different role. And it's the president who has to make all these decisions, but he has to listen to a whole bunch of other people than Dr. Fauci. And, you know, there's got to be somebody has to show a little humility uh-huh. here in when they're looking at Trump's performance. I mean, obviously he's not doing that great of a job, or he didn't do a great job, but Jesus Christ, who would have done a great job?
Well,
you know?
It's such a good point, because for all of the criticism of Trump trying to be an authoritarian strongman, the media response often seems to be looking for an authoritarian strongman who isn't Trump yeah. to tell us all what Precisely. To do, who we can all trust.
Where's the backlash to Gretchen Whitmer's extremely excessive lockdown on
in
non-essential items for purchase, including seeds for your garden and infant car seats so you can't take your child home from the neonatal care center if you, you know, just had a baby? Who's going out against that besides the right? What, you know, you have to be a positive, you just have to be an android to look at these massive lines of cars outside of food banks where people are saying we need the National Guard to help us maintain this the amount of outflow that we're having here because this can't last for two more weeks. You know, who's freaked out about that besides the right? Certainly not the press.
Right. Now, I will say that there is one aspect of this that I found humorous, which is that the guy in the White House who wrote something in January saying there's a pandemic we have to prepare for is this protectionist Peter Navarro, you know, who is, I guess you would call him an economist. I mean, he's not a professional economist, but he's sort of the trade. He's like the trade war guy, Peter Navarro. So he wrote some memo or had some memo written for him or whatever saying this at the end of January, but we only found out about Peter Navarro's view because there was a story about how he started yelling at Fauci in a White House meeting, like in the last week of March, about how Fauci was shutting the economy down and he needed to reopen.
Yeah.
So what's the story? And then somehow Navarro managed to come out that Navarro had written this memo because he had looked bad in this fight with Fauci, who was then, you know, the godhead. So in January, though, what Navarro saw was a political advantage, which was he wants to be tough on China. He really wanted Trump to put trade restrictions and a travel ban on China. So he said, China's going to kill us all. Okay? So that's his view in January. And then come March, the right-wing view had shifted to we're overreacting. We're overreacting. This is an overreaction. So the same guy who said there's a pandemic coming, we need to basically shut down our relationship with China, 2 months later is like, Anthony Fauci, you're being a hysteric. Open the economy up, because his political interests had changed from January to March, which I think is a kind of indication of it's like the reverse version of Mark Levine of the New York City Council saying, go into as many giant crowded situations as possible and lick other people's faces. That's how you show that Trump is wrong about this terrible travel ban, to, you know, run for your lives, you know, take your 90-year-old grandmother and put her on an ice floe for her own safety.
you know, that's another thing that has been memory hold is the notion that the left wasn't attacking Trump's very permeable travel ban on nationals from China, which is not really a travel ban, but was theatrical enough to get everybody excised about it. And the WHO came down on him. Everyone in New York City came down on him in public office. Half the media came down on him. I mean, if you missed it, you just weren't looking. And I was skeptical of these travel bans. It was permeable enough to assuage me because it allows for these kind of contacts that you need and information sharing to effectively address this sort of a situation. But a full travel ban would have been ultimately counterproductive. They didn't even do it.
Yeah.
Right. So Andy, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, I was just, that's just a part of the same debate. I mean, how on earth were you going to tell American citizens who were in China that they can't come back to their own country?
Right.
When you don't have a crisis right in front of you.
Right. So there was a repatriation project. And also that the State Department, I mean, another, you know, canary in the coal mine, the State Department evacuated everybody from Wuhan like the minute this whole thing happened.
Right. So, guys, let's take a break and let me talk to you about today's advertiser, NetSuite. Look, there's enough uncertainty to go around right now, and NetSuite reduces it by giving you visibility and control. With so many decisions to make, so many critical decisions to make, you need the right numbers, and you need them right now. So let's talk about NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. With NetSuite, we give you financials, cash flow, payroll, inventory, and more, all in one place, so you have clear visibility and total control of your business. NetSuite customers have the flexibility to work from anywhere with immediate clarity on critical information right at their fingertips. No more guessing, no more waiting. Make smarter decisions with confidence because you've got crystal clear visibility into your numbers. Join over 20,000 companies who trust NetSuite to stay in control. So receive your free guide, Managing Business Uncertainty, and schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/commentary. Don't wait. Get your free guide and schedule your free product tour at netsuite.com/commentary, netsuite.com/commentary. So, Andy, as a presidential historian.
I'm an existential historian.
You're a historian of all things. So we have news that Trump has raised, I don't know, $638 million for his presidential campaign. And like the Democrats have like $4 or something. Biden has like $4 or $5. And this somehow is supposed to prove that, you know, this is a Biden's in a terrible circumstance. is there going to be a presidential campaign?
Well, that all depends on whether, you know, Trump reopens the country as he wants to do. you know, the thing about the money, it's a we all, you know, there's so little news in politics in general, even when there's not a pandemic going on, that people grasp for metrics. And one of the great ones is how much money people have raised. And it matters early on in primaries and things, but for the general election, it's not going to make any difference at all. Nobody is not going to know who Joe Biden is. Nobody is not going to know what he wants to do when he gets elected president. So all of that stuff is just, you know, there's got to be a lot of better things people can do with $650 million and spend it on advertisements for Donald Trump.
I can't help but feel like this whole situation advantages Joe Biden, despite the money, because the notion that we'll have a conventional presidential campaign in the summer and the fall seems remote at this point. And it's Biden's desire to run essentially a front porch campaign, in which he doesn't have to do a lot of traveling, doesn't have to speak extemp very often. Donald Trump lives on audiences. He thrives in an audience environment. He can read a room like no one else. So in the absence of an audience for rallies, even debates, maybe, I mean, that's the sort of thing that would disadvantage him, you would have to think, because, you know, think to how Joe Biden performed in the last debate against Bernie Sanders, where there was no one else in the room, and it was probably his best debate, because he just didn't have that pressure on him to think so fast. I think that just ultimately helps Joe Biden in the long run.
Well, and he's aided and abetted now by a media establishment that will come behind him. I mean, he had this completely anodyne op-ed in the Times over the weekend, you know, sort of, here, if I were president, here's what I'd be doing. None of which was particularly, I mean, he just was synthesizing what everyone's already been saying for weeks. There was nothing new there. There was nothing, but he was given a lot of space to make his case. And at the same time, we'll see how much digging and dirt digging there'll be on him, in going forward from the media. I think, I mean, obviously Trump is going to throw whatever will stick to the wall at him, but he's not likely to be scrutinized carefully by the media establishment.
Well,
so there were two stories this weekend, right? One in the Washington Post, one in the New York Times, about this allegation.
Yeah, I was trying to avoid talking about it, but yeah.
Right, but the reason I want to bring it up
is... It's a different one, though, isn't it? It's the second one. Yeah,
no,
the Senate aid?
No,
I think it's all the same woman.
Woman. Yeah. Tara Reid. So, not Tara Reid. Tara Reid's an actress.
Hey, she was in Sharknado.
Right, she was. Yeah.
She is a fine actress.
She was great in Sharknado.
And Sharknado 4.
Can't beat Sharknado. The finest moment on Twitter was the night when everybody was live tweeting Sharknado.
Not and come together as a nation.
Yes. Yes. But, no.
Her name is Tara Reid, by the way.
Oh, Tara. Oh, it is Tara Reid. Okay,
but it's spelled R-E-A-D.
Yeah.
Okay, so... The point about these stories was that they were written from the aspect of debunkery. And to be fair, they were quite rigorously done. They checked everything. You know, there's no evidence. There's no contemporaneous evidence. It's her brother says he told her, you know, she's a Sanders supporter, whatever. Okay, so, but what was interesting, of course, was that she has a little more evidence that Brett Kavanaugh ever had, than Brett Kavanaugh's accuser ever had. And of course, that was entirely taken at face value. And the New York Times and Washington Post have done this story to debunk it effectively. Although, again, I think the stories are sufficiently honest.
The Times story wasn't that honest, because they had this amazing thing that they tweeted and then retracted and then changed the story, talk about memory holding in real time, where they had said, you know, there have been no other allegations about, you know, there's no evidence that Biden has ever done this to anyone else, except for the many women who said they felt uncomfortable with how he was hugging, sniffing, and kissing them. And so then they had to retract that, because obviously people were like, not great for the brand. Yeah.
Right. But the story itself does not, I mean, all the story says is that there have been no allegation of specific wrongdoing.
Right.
And her account is, and then she went to the cops to issue some kind of...
In D.C., yes.
In D.C. to issue some kind of a allegation, but didn't name Biden.
Report.
Yeah, she filed a police report.
She filed a police report without naming Biden, because, of course, once she names Biden, he can counter-sue her. Or, you know, like, he can sue her for slander, which I think is the likeliest thing, is that she is slandering him. And, of course, this just proves that if you want to make a really disturbing allegation against somebody without evidence, you better
make sure
do
they're
it
a Republican.
because there'll be a lot of credulousness about it. But in that sense, you know, Biden's, you know, I mean, so the thing that gets me is that it's always this reversion to priors, right? Which is money. Trump has all this money. Oh my God, he's got all this money. And remember, like, the whole point about Trump's campaign is that he spent half of what the Republican, what his Republican challenger spent, I believe, to get the nomination in 2016. Jeb Bush spent $135 million. Marco Rubio spent $120 million. Ted Cruz spent about $140 million. He spent something like $70 million. So he didn't need the money. I mean, you know, obviously he needed money to build some infrastructure and Facebooking and whatever the hell else he did. But it's like, are we really going to go through this again? We have to go through this again. It's like 30 years of this nonsense about how money controls everything. Now, money is like Plato's cave in politics because it scares people who are in the cave, right? It's like, well, I can't run. I don't have any money. Or, you know, Pete Buttigieg dropped out because he didn't have any money. Well, you know, if Pete Buttigieg had caught fire, he A, might have gotten money, or B, wouldn't have needed the money because he would have had all earned media and he wouldn't have needed money. You know, that's why he had to drop out even though he won one of the first three primaries. Money, 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 right? All throughout this thing, it's like, oh my God, what a great day. Amy Klobuchar raised $6 million. She got all this money after her debate performance. And it's like, and then Biden, who had less money than anybody else did, ran away with the nomination. And Bernie Sanders, who has raised something like $600 million over the last 4 years, managed to get 40,000 people to vote for him in Nevada. And, you know, I don't know how many people vote for him in Iowa. I can't even remember that number. And that's what he got for his $600 million. I mean, so it's tiresome, but it's never going to end.
Well, it's one of those things. It's a demand side problem, which afflicts all of political journalism, which is there are too many reporters chasing too little news. And, you know, as I said, you just grab onto anything and go, ooh, here's a figure. Here's a dollar figure from Amy Klobuchar. And, you know, all of a sudden today we have a story, you know.
I mean, it is a story. I don't mean that it's
well,
nothing.
Well, everything's a story in that sense. But I mean, it has no significance aside from.
Right.
Small dollar donors matter as a measure of public support.
Yes, that's a fairly new phenomenon, though.
I mean, but again, Sanders had 10 zillion low-dollar donors, and you know, and that didn't mean that he didn't lose by 30 points in South Carolina once there was an actual primary with a lot of people voting. The other interesting story, by the way, in terms of the virus killed off his chances and all of that, is that he lost Alaska by 10 points over the weekend. Biden won Alaska by 10 points. It's an all mail in election, which means that people might have been voting a month ago, and it was his second best state after Vermont in 2016. So the idea that Sanders didn't collapse, even where he had done well, is now, you know, I mean, I don't know how many more times it has to be disproved, and it probably doesn't really have to be disproved. It's now fun to watch the Sanders rump trying to destroy the Democratic
Party. Band name, I call it. I'm sorry.
What do you call it?
Band name.
Oh.
A band's name.
Right.
Alternative rock band.
So the Democratic Socialists of America, you know, which was that, you remember when everybody said, oh, socialism is back, because the Democratic Socialists of America, which was started by Michael Harrington, as an offshoot of the Socialist Party, because the Socialist Party was taken over by the AFL-CIO and therefore was bad and not New Left enough. So Democratic Socialists had this like surge in membership because of Bernie Sanders to like 50,000 nationwide. You know, so they now announced they were not going to endorse Joe Biden. Mm. I mean, Democrats are not endorsing Joe Biden. And then Biden's press secretary, Sanders' press secretary, Breonna Joy Gray, what did she do? She like listed all the allegations, Tara Reade's allegations against
Well, all the things that they so virtuously didn't talk about when Bernie was still in the race. But now, of course, she had Burisma on the list, too. I mean, it basically read like a Trump tweet, in all honesty. Yeah.
Sort of gives away the game when you're saying, you know, we declined to litigate this allegation of sexual abuse because it would have been just too uncouth. It was unseemly.
Exactly.
Right. You know, I just to go a little larger for a second on the question of Biden here, I think he does have a significant challenge right now, which is that, is there room for him in all of this? You know, like, what does he say and what's his justification? If he was the guy, if Biden was going to return the country to a sense of order and sanity, that is now not going to happen with or without Biden, right? I mean, everything is turned on its head anyway. He simply cannot promise to bring us back to normal.
Right. That's a fair point. But also, I mean, that it's to his advantage, again, to not have to be anything to anyone, just completely withdraw from the situation, exist as a hypothetical alternative, and then leave you to make your mind up there. The second he starts putting meat on those bones, you don't know what he's talking about.
Right.
The less talking he does, the better.
I just don't think it matters. I mean, this election is about Trump. Trump had a hope of making the election about Biden the way that Obama successfully kind of made the election about Romney in 2012 in his reelection. But the election's not about Biden. Biden won't rise to the level of being a subject of the, could you really trust Biden with something like the virus? When, you know, unless the handling of the virus here on in is a triumph of logistics and wonderment, you know, I mean, 50% of the country at a minimum is going to think that he didn't do a good job. He can still win.
There's no way to project out too far. But if you believe the experts insofar as you can, then there's going to be this sort of a false sense of normalcy returning in the mid to late summer, which will be fleeting and then disappear as the weather gets colder. According to what, you know, if anybody believes the notion that this thing is temperature sensitive, then at least the amount of people outside who can be outside will arrest some of its spread, and then it'll come right back in the fall. So
I just don't know
what dynamics that prevail today will prevail then.
I just don't understand what kind of normalcy will prevail. It will not be normal. No. There will not be baseball this summer. There will be no baseball this summer. Yeah. It is likely that the NFL will cancel its season or shift it or say they can't start until December or something like that. There's not going to be a Democratic convention. There will likely not be a Republican convention. There is no Olympics, which is not here, but, you know, there will not be July 4th parades. There will not be July 4th mass picnics. There will not be the Sturgis motorcycle rally. I'm trying to think of everything that happens in America in the summer. So even if there's normalcy in the sense that some restaurants reopen, movie theaters are not going to reopen. I mean, it's unlikely that movie theaters will be open in at least, you know, half the country, even if they can open in the other half. There will be, it's not going to be normal.
I agree it's not going to be normal, but I think you might be selling the scientists a little short because, you know, we're talking 4 or 5 months from now. You've got every smart person in the world trying not just to figure out new kinds of tests, but also treatments. It's not just an antidote that they're looking for.
Right.
And you could have a couple of very effective treatments. You'll also, if you're doing a lot more testing, you'll be able to isolate, you know, the essential people who have to be isolated, people with diabetes and so on, older people. So it might not be quite as weird as you're saying. I mean, there might be some kind of resemblance to normalcy if you've got serious treatments and you've got really good testing going on.
Right, but I'm still saying, let's say it even achieves 75% normality. That 25% is a killer. I mean, just as Trump didn't shut the country down and he can't open it up, the question is, what will lead people to go to a mall? What will lead people to go to a stadium? What would lead people to go to
a
movie?
I will go to a mall tomorrow.
I know.
No joke. I'm not kidding.
I know, but
the second anything opens up around me, I am competent enough and capable enough to navigate my environment safely.
Right.
And I think a lot of people will make that conclusion.
The one thing, if the public health officials say, all you need to do is wear a mask and keep 6 feet apart. That's what you need to do. And wear a mask, keep 6 feet apart, maybe wear gloves. Okay, that's what you need to do. You can go to a mall, you can go shopping, you can do whatever you want. Just wear a mask and keep 6 feet apart. That might be very reassuring to people, but then you're at a mall and someone's 3 feet from you and you're a paranoid person anyway. And then you turn around and start shrieking at the person for being 3 feet from you. And then a fight breaks out, and then a cop comes over and tries to break you up. And then you say, don't touch me, you're not 6 feet from me. And someone has a cell phone camera out and shows it, and then no one goes to a mall again. I'm just saying, it's like, that's why I say could be a simulacrum of normal that isn't normal in any way, shape, or form.
Not only that, my fear, and I think I sort of see this happening in real time now, is that the longer this goes on, the less confident people are in their abilities to do what Noah just described, to go out there and use their own judgment to avoid this. I think 2 weeks ago, if you had said, regardless of the conditions, if you had said, okay, you can go out there, just wear a mask and use good judgment, it would have made a kind of sense to a larger portion of the population than today. I think because, like any rut, the longer this goes on, the harder it is to get out of it psychologically. I think you feel, despite the sacrifices and the boredom and the tedium and the money in there, at least you feel, okay, there's a kind of protection in this that I don't want to give up in the lockdown.
Right. Well, I keep contrasting, the constant comparison here in New York is to 9/11. And where it is different and where this is an eerie and discomforting moment is that, you know, after 9/11, so New York is attacked, 3,000 people die. We thought it was like 20,000 people in the first, you know, week and a half. It turned out not to be that, thank God. But there was the sense like everybody was in shock and everybody looked at everybody else and smiled. Like there was a kind of, you know, it's like we're living through this together. You're wonderful. I'm wonderful. America's wonderful. You know, this is just a horrible thing that's been done to us. You know, you basically could have hugged anybody. And now, walking through the park yesterday with my daughter, and you walk and like people are looking at you as though you are Typhoid Mary. I mean, they are looking at you with fear and anxiety, or maybe it's just, I'm reading that because you're not seeing anybody's face. You're just seeing these eyes often because of the masks, and that you can read anything into an expression like that.
I was going to say, I had exactly the opposite experience here. I mean, out in front of my house in Arlington, Virginia, was like a Easter Day parade of people enjoying the beautiful weather and out, and everybody, they were all behaving responsibly and keeping their distance, but they were all extremely friendly with each other and greeting each other and all that sort of thing. One thing that we have to avoid here, and this is going to be a big problem with the media, is to New Yorkify this, which is not to acknowledge that New York's experience, and Cuomo has been trying to emphasize this, what you are seeing here today is going to be you in 3 weeks. Well, I think we can say with pretty high confidence that that's not true.
Right.
And I have to also agree with that. And I'm only 45 minutes outside the city in the suburbs. We've experienced as much community as you can make in this situation. And to the extent that I'm out, it's at grocery stores and Costco, and everybody's is very friendly and very warm. And
Is everybody wearing a mask?
Not entirely, for the most part. Actually, there are quite a few workers at these places that are not using protective gear. But, you know, you can also just take it down for a minute and like have a conversation.
Andy, was everybody wearing a mask?
No, I'd say less than half.
Okay, so I'm telling you, like, almost everybody is wearing a mask here now. And it has a different, you cannot, have that.
I'm sure, but that's not going to be my point is that's not right. going to be the experience of the rest of the country.
No, I'm not saying it is. I don't think it is. Although I'm sorry, but the key, according to my friend, the doctor who is involved in the COVID response here in New York, what they will say is absolutely go out and reopen everything, but you have to wear a mask. And so 300 million people may end up wearing masks. Like it could be just the price of, not 300 million, let's say 200 million. You'll see what it's like when everybody is wearing a mask when you walk down the street. And, you know, it is...
I mean, John, this is my life, though. I mean, everybody who's, you know, who's not exposing themselves on a daily basis to this thing and seems to have given up is wearing masks, is wearing gloves, is standing in line to get into places. And there is no, you know, social discord yet.
It's not social discord. I'm not talking about discord. There's no discord, in part because it's so unpleasant to talk when you have the mask on your face and you prefer to be silent, which also creates a certain element of discord. I'm only saying this because it's a different kind of solidarity, because the solidarity is based in part on we're having this terrible shared experience, except you could make me sick. Like that is a
well, there's suspicion. Yeah, there's a suspicion. You have to kind of be wary and suspicious in a way that you didn't in post 9/11 New York, unless perhaps you were, you know, Muslim and worried that there would be some backlash. Right, right.
Yeah, and I just don't know. I just think it's if the national sense is that, you know, we reopen by wearing masks, then the country is going to be walking around in masks. And it's not nice. It's like it's not something that's easy to get used to. I don't know what it's like in the countries where they, you know, I don't know what it's like in Hong Kong or Japan where they got used to doing this a lot more, or what those, you know, cultures are like ordinarily, really. So it's not as though New Yorkers were always, you know, much friendlier than people gave them credit for being, and also much more informal than a lot of other places. And so this imposes a kind of formality that is itself very weird in a place like New York.
Well, whereas in Japan, it's pretty, you will frequently, without a pandemic in sight, see people wearing masks. It's considered polite to wear it. If you have any sort of cold, you wear a mask to protect others. And, you know, there's a lot of form there, but there's so much more formality built into the structure of their social interactions anyway.
Well, Andy, Andy Ferguson, as a social historian, because we're turning to you in your role as a social, presidential, cultural, existential,
and moral historian.
That's right. Which book of yours should people read during their quarantine?
He's a marketing historian.
Yeah. I wouldn't know where to begin since there's only three of them.
Right.
You can't miss, basically.
Yeah, you can't.
I think that's what I'd say. There's no wrong answer to that question, I guess is what I mean.
It's funny, though. So I was walking with my daughter yesterday, who was in 10th grade, and she said to me, it's a dumb question. I don't want to ask you. It's a dumb question. And I said, well, you got nothing but time. Ask any question. No question is dumb or something. And she said, you know, the college tours, like, how do they work? How do you do it? How do you do a college tour? How does it function? And I was like, crazy you! That's Andy's book on what is your subtitle? One Man's Quest to Get His Son into College?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. I've got it around here somewhere.
Anyway, so I'm going to have to go back and read. You know, I was like, well, you know, you make an appointment and you go.
That was a very hard one chapter. I had to do so many of those college tours. But, I mean, most parents do, people in our situation anyway. And so that there was blood on every page.
Well, there's blood on... Andy, let's face it. There's blood on every page when you write.
That's true.
You are. Andy is a sufferer. Andy suffers for his art.
I'm a suffering historian.
He's a suffering historian of suffering. That's correct. Now, Christine is actually a historian.
This is
right?
True. I have a PhD in history. That's true.
That's right. Yeah. And I have a BA in political science. So, and so, you know, I can talk about anything with absolutely no expertise whatsoever.
The generalist is an underappreciated role.
I agree with that.
Yes.
Not everybody can just talk extemporaneously on any subject. That's why you're a cable news contributor.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to say one other thing about Andy before we go. One of the greatest things that Andy ever did, this is like 20 years ago, or 23 years ago. So you may remember that in the year of Lewinsky, which started in January of 1998, there were three cable news channels, as there are now, really. Maybe four, because CNBC was more of a cable news channel. So you had MSN, CNN, and Fox. And so they talked about nothing but Lewinsky for 9-10 months. And they had these shows. And so basically, if you were somebody who wrote an article somewhere in the last 40 years, they called you 5 times a week.
They also paid you in those days, though.
Yeah,
they paid you for it.
Some of them did, and some of them didn't, right? But they would pay you. Then you would go on.
Let's just say they paid me. Okay, right. They're going.
Well, maybe they didn't pay you enough, because this is the story I'm going to tell about you. So they, so you go on, and then it was like the Brady Bunch, or Hollywood Squares. There were like 6 or 9 people in a grid, like Zoom. You know, 6 or 9 people in a grid with the host in the center. And then everybody was somehow supposed to talk when they could for like it. And you would go on and you might be in this grid for 5 minutes. So you would drive to the studio, you put on makeup, you'd wait for half an hour, 45 minutes. You'd go on for 3 minutes in this grid of 8 people, and then you would leave. And you would just say the same thing. Oh, well, the blue dress. It's a DNA test. Sidney Blumenthal shouldn't have been hauled in front of this. And you put this like May, and you said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing
That's
this
when
anymore.
They stopped paying me.
You know what? It seemed a lot grander at the time. You seem to be much more principled about it. I think you're like defaulting into the I was just, you know, I wasn't enough. They didn't pay me enough to be a whore. You were more like, this is demeaning. This is the opposite of anything real or meaningful or good. Like, I'm contributing to some bad trend in American culture, and you just stop going on TV.
Well, you know, there actually was a turning point then. There was sort of an aha moment. I was on, I guess it was called Hardball then. What's his name's show?
Chris Matthews.
Chris Matthews. I think it just started.
Hardball then, too. Yeah.
Hardball, yeah. And there had been some crisis of the century that afternoon, some huge revelation. And I'm sitting next to him, you know, and I have my dental smock on because he sprays all this spit whenever he opens his mouth. And that's when, you know, they could have been issuing nice little mouth coverings in those days, too. But anyway, so he turns to me and he says, so, Ferguson, what is Hillary thinking about this? And, of course, the only possible answer to that is, how the hell do I know? Her husband probably doesn't know. You know, I'd never laid eyes on the woman. I'd never met the woman. But I realized in the back of my mind, if I say the obvious, which is I have no freaking idea, he's never going to have me back on. And so I heard myself say, well, Chris, what I'm hearing from people. And then I went on with it. And afterwards,
a little piece of your soul died.
yes. Something had gone out of me and I was never going to get it back. And that's when I decided it wasn't. Also, they didn't pay me. That was the other thing.
Yeah.
Well, that made me feel warm for you.
Yeah,
it's actually got a little hot in here.
That's like the story of how I ended up leaving government, which is that I worked quite briefly in government, I was a speechwriter for Reagan. And then when the Bush administration started, I was a special assistant to Bill Bennett, and we were setting up the drug czar's office. And so this office was very shaggy. It was for Bill and John Walters, who is now at the Hudson Institute as his chief of staff, and three or four of us aides. And the office was sort of slowly staffing up. And the general tenor was there was no real work exactly. We were going around talking to various agencies about what they do and all this. So it was all just sitting around talking about what we should be doing, because, of course, this office was ridiculous nonsense, created by Joe Biden, by the way, as part of the Drug Act of 1988, and, you know, to coordinate our drug policy with no power or authority. Anyway, and so there was so we go in and out of each other's offices all day, and John Walters, who was the chief of staff, his office was sort of like the center office because he was the chief of staff. And at some point, I walked into his office, and he was having a meeting with a military aide and the budget, the guy who did the budget. And I walked in, the office was closed, and John said, "You know what, John, can you excuse us for a minute? You shouldn't really be in this meeting." So I walked out of the office, and I closed the door, and I felt like I had died. Because if I wasn't in this meeting, what was I? I was 28 Ooh. Years old. I didn't know what to do. I was like, I was crushed. I felt devastated. And I had just been offered my old job at the Washington Times. And I had said no, because I wasn't going to go back. And it was the same job that I had had when I left. And you know, here I was in this sort of fashionable, ritzy new agency. And I went back to my office feeling like death. And I picked up the phone and I called Arnaud de Borgrove, who had offered me the job. And I took it because I thought, if this can make me feel this way, this is not a life that this is not the life for me. Like, I can't allow this to be my emotion as an aide. Like, I'm not cut out for it. That's a story I've never really told, actually, but it's, I mean, I've told friends know it, but.
And the drug problem in America only got worse.
Now we know who to blame.
No, because I suggested that we have a total travel ban from Colombia. Anyway, so those kinds of stories about, like, you know, those moments when you go, you know what, this is not for me, or this is not who I should be. But Andy, you barely went on television after that, right?
That's true. Just to promote books, I think.
Yeah. So, well, Noah and I will never be on television again, as far as I can tell.
I've accumulated plenty of humiliating moments in my time. So.
Haven't we all? My most humiliating moment was when Joe Scarborough asked me, because I had been joking on set about, just before we went on, about having watched The Bachelor the previous night. So he said, "John Podoritz, you watched The Bachelor last night. What happened?" I'm like, "Oh, Joe, you wouldn't believe it. It was so awful, because this happened and that happened." And then the caption under my name was, "John Podoritz, Bachelor in
Oh, that is epic.
And then friends of mine, like, took screen caps and sent them to me. And this is like, now that is the end. And I was, you know, and then I could even say, "Look, I only watch it because my wife likes it," which is not entirely
That's
true.
That's just adorable, anyway. Though. That's nothing to be embarrassed about. That's a fun one.
It was bad. I'm sorry. They thought it was adorable.
My worst was during the early part of the campaign, and we were interviewing Julian Castro, and then I had the setup to a question for him. It was a big, long setup. I read him part of his speech and asked him for a comment on it, and then he graciously informed me that I was quoting his brother on air. That was a rough one. Yikes. I took credit, by the way, for him growing the beard. I think I did that.
So you could tell him apart.
Mm-hmm. And now you guys don't know this, but Noah has that very beard.
Right. Yes.
So Noah is now sporting
tell me apart from my brother, who already has a beard.
There you go.
We're bearded.
Yeah. So, guys, anybody else have any embarrassing anecdotes there before we close?
Now, the NDAs I've signed have prevented me from discussing any of those moments.
I share all these stories with the bartender in the lobby, Lloyd. We have very scintillating conversations every night.
Words of wisdom, Lloyd.
I'm going to miss that, truly.
Yes.
He makes a great martini.
He does. Well, you know what you have to do. You know what you have to do.
They need to be corrected.
Yes. there are probably 90% of the audience has no idea what we're riffing on. It's the Jack Nicholson and the bartender in The Shining. That's that was just a little improv there. Noah and me, frustrated actors.
And my hair looks like Nicholson's at this point. Just it pretty much looked like any Carter administration official, just very flowing off.
That is actually not true, but okay. All right, so Andy, thank you for joining us again and giving us the benefit of your social, moral, cultural, presidential, existential, and political and suffering historianship.
Yeah, I'm going to get some more adjectives there, but next time I'm on.
Yes, and so for Christine, we'll be back tomorrow. Christine and Abe and Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.